At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
I actually turned a little bit schizophrenic for a while, and then I became a raging alcoholic.
That freaks some people out.
Jonathan Davis was never your average rock star. He was the weird kid, bullied, broken, working in a morgue.
I should have been seeing shit at 17 years old that I saw. Fucked me up for a long time after that.
But then came porn, and with it came everything else. Addiction, panic attacks, death, heartbreak. He faced it all, and somehow he's still standing.
Straight up, there's nothing tough about me.
This is the story of Jonathan Davis. Jonathan Houseman Davis entered the world in 1971 in Bakersfield, California. Hardly the birthplace you'd expect for a future rock icon.
I was born and raised here. I like country stuff.
His childhood was anything but golden. As a little kid, he was in and out of hospitals with severe asthma, even flatlining once before being yanked back from the brink.
It's happened to me a lot. I've had a lot of near-death experiences. I wasn't out there, it was just like, because I had asthma so bad, they'd sit me and they'd just tell my parents, if we get him through the night, he has a chance. A lot of stuff like that. I grew up in fucking tents. They would stick you in a tent over your bed and you'd lay there, and they gave you this fucking horrible drug called Quibron, which is like cocaine and alcohol.
I wanted that drug when I was a kid.
How old were you when you got that?
I had horrible asthma started when I was 3 years old. So it was around being 4, 5, 6 years old. That was like the old drug they gave you. And the only thing to open up your airways is like epinephrine and stuff like that. So it was drugs like that that would help me breathe.
His parents split up when he was 3, and Jonathan ended up living with his dad and a stepmom who, by all accounts, made his life hell. This domineering stepmother resented the boy and allegedly pulled cruel stunts like spiking his tea with hot chili oils just to watch him suffer.
That time sucked.
It was the kind of twisted upbringing that could break anyone. But for Jonathan, the anger became energy. The trauma became lyrics. And with a father that was somewhat in the music business, he already had a map. All he had to do was follow the pain.
And your dad was a musician.
Yeah, my dad was a musician. My mother was, they were both in the theater. My mom danced and acted in the plays, and my dad was always in the band, and he also was a touring musician. So I was always surrounded by music.
Then there was the darkest secret of all, a childhood scar that wouldn't stay buried. When he was little, Jonathan endured trauma no child should ever suffer. He was violated in a way we can't describe here. But when he tried to tell his family, they didn't believe him, which in itself is also very traumatic. The betrayal and hurt from that would later pour out in Korn's infamous song, Daddy, a harrowing track where Jonathan screams and sobs through the memories. So by his late teens, Jonathan was carrying around more baggage than most of us could imagine. And school wasn't any safer. He was that weird kid nobody understood.
I'm a merry sissy faggoty man. Straight up, there's nothing tough about me. And that's why I always got picked on. I wasn't ashamed to say that I'm sensitive. I'm not ashamed to say that I cry. I'm not ashamed that I get my feelings hurt over stuff, because those are real emotions. I think people need to deal with those
deal with those things, and then it wouldn't be so bad. You know, there's a stigma around you got to be a man, and I've always hated. I've always had a problem with that. Yeah. I think I'm more man than any, you know, tough guy, if I can say those things. In my opinion.
Yeah. Amen.
The only safe place was music. He developed an early love for Duran Duran.
In a place like Bakersfield, a place like Indiana, for us to love bands like Duran Duran was not cool.
I get kicked in the ass.
Yeah. That's not what jocks were listening to.
No, hence the song Faggot. You know, I was considered that because I pegged my pants. I wore eyeliner.
Yeah.
And I had to, it was funny because I was living with my dad at the time and he forbid me from doing that. So I had to sneak. And once I got out of the house and got to school, I'd run to the bathroom and put my eyeliner on, pick my pants and do all this shit. But that's what I was into at that time. But those farm boy dudes were not having it.
Being a sensitive gothic kid, he was unfortunately bullied and picked on.
I was picked on just so bad. I had like guidance counselors telling me I was gay, and they're sending me to gay counselors, and I'm just like telling those fools, what the fuck? I'm telling you, I'm straight. Oh, but you need to go and see this. It's like, the fuck is going on? I don't know what's going on. So it was just that weird mentality at that time.
In school, he joined the choir and picked up the bagpipes. Not your typical start to a rock career.
And I listened to everything. So there wasn't necessarily any kind of certain style of music. I just listened to everything. And when I got into junior high, that's when I think sixth grade junior high is when MTV started. And actually MTV Bakersfield was a test market for it at the time. And I actually saw the first, when they came on the air and they played Video Killed the Radio Star. I saw that and I sat my ass in front of that TV all the time and just watched all those videos and all those bands. And that just made me start thinking, I don't want to do this. I so want to do this.
But things took a darker turn when he got a job as a coroner's assistant, spending his days surrounded by death.
On the weekends when I go hang out at my mom's house and stuff, we go to the video store and we go rent videos. And I was really into horror films. So those really led me in to becoming a coroner's assistant back in the day when I did autopsies, because I loved horror films so much. It was something about being scared and just that dark vibe.
At that time, I've always just been, I don't know, something about dark stuff has always grabbed me. So I'm like, I wonder what it's like to go cut up dead bodies. So I did three interviews to get in. They had to do a psych background, everything. And I finally got in. And I started doing autopsies at 17. So I did that 17, 18. And then I went to Frisco and went to the San Francisco College of Mortuary Science and became a mortician. Came back here, was an embalmer. And then at night, I would go to the coroner's office and I was studying to be an investigator. So I didn't have to get my hands dirty per se doing autopsy. I'd just be an investigator and go investigate, you know, deaths.
Really crazy time in my life. I mean, it fucked me up for a long time after that, but I didn't know it, but later it would fuck me up. I shouldn't have been seeing shit at 17 years old that I saw. But but I did it, and I was really into it for a while.
This is fucking depressing shit. It was very sad. I mean, every day I was dealing with just poor people losing their loved ones, and in the funeral business, it's you see it more. And when I was just working as an autopsy assistant, and the more doing autopsies, it's me, some stiffs, and a doctor. That's it. And that was I could deal with. But when you actually see the families and stuff like that, it started to get to me. And then when I was young doing autopsy, I was autopsying kids and stuff like that. So it was it was bad. I'm glad I got out of it. But I mean, I'm glad I did it. It got me to where I'm at now. But I saw a lot of really crazy shit.
Around the same time, he joined a local band called Sex Art, but they weren't going anywhere.
And the note said, let there be sex art, let there be screaming.
Then came one random night in 1993 that changed everything. He was playing a gig at some Bakersfield club when three guys, Monkey, Fieldy, and David, saw him perform. They were part of a different local band, and they just lost their singer. So after seeing Jonathan performing up there, they knew immediately he was their guy. After the set, they asked him to join their band, but he wasn't sure what to do. Jonathan being Jonathan, he didn't turn to logic. Instead, shortly after, he turned to a psychic, and she told him exactly what he needed to hear. Take the leap and join that fucking band. So he gave it a shot, rehearsed with the guys, and after just one session, he knew this was where he belonged.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
The band that emerged would call itself Korn.
Me and some of my friends and beggars from back in the day were at this party, and there was two gay guys talking about how they loved touching each other.
Okay.
And the one dude was talking that he was touching his lover, and the guy shit all over his face. He had a corn kernel on his tongue.
Okay, got it.
So that's how it came about.
Our manager at the time, Larry, we told him we're going to call it Korn, and he's like, you can't name your band Korn. So we told him, well, we're going to name it Larry then. And he's like, fuck you. I'm like, it's going to be either Larry or Korn. You fucking pick. I fucking chuckle to this day that my band's name is Korn. It's fucking funny. We twisted it and spelled it different with the backwards R, and it made it kind of like spooky, and it worked.
Korn's lineup solidified in 1993. Jonathan on vocals, James Monkey Schaffer, and Brian Head Welch on seven-string guitars, Reginald Fieldy Arvizu on bass, and David Silveria on drums.
Fieldy was the telemarketer because he was the telemark. Fieldy get on the phone and he would hit promoters up and book a show. So he's like, man, we need a logo. We got to send him a logo. I grabbed a crayon and a piece of paper and I wrote Korn with my left hand like a child would write it. And that became the logo. And then we burned it into a screen printer and we started pulling stickers. And then we smacked them everywhere. From Huntington Beach to Sacramento, we slapped those stickers on stop signs. And people started going, what the fuck is Korn?
It was out of control, dude. Like every street sign in Huntington had a Korn sticker on it.
Oh my God.
It was out of control.
Their turning point came when a representative from a small label under Sony caught a show at Huntington Beach's Crawl Space Club. The band's intensity on stage, particularly Jonathan's unhinged performance, was so feral and brutal that the label signed them almost on the spot. Ross Robinson, the godfather of nu metal, was tasked with producing their debut album, and the band entered Indigo Ranch Studios in Malibu. There, Jonathan let it all out, recording vocals in complete darkness, often semi-naked, pacing like a caged animal to get into the right headspace. The result was a 1994 self-titled debut album that didn't sound like anything else in the industry. A wild fusion of down-tuned, rumbling metal riffs and hip-hop grooves with Jonathan's tortured, cathartic vocals on top.
The genius of that cover was Monkey. Monkey's the one that came with that idea. He's like, this girl looking up in the sun and you see a shadow. You don't know what it is. And then when we saw it, holy fuck, it was amazing. That freaked some people out.
It's kind of show you like the dark side of everything that's innocent, pretty much, you know, because without this, it's an innocent picture. But when you add the shadow, it's the dark side to the picture. You know what I mean?
It was so spooky, that album cover, the way it looked, see the band. There's just so many different things that contradicted each other. Are you ready?
Nobody could predict it, but Korn had just kicked off a cultural evolution.
It didn't match anything in the world. It was too goth and femme. You know, Jonathan's flamboyancy, and then the music was all dark and heavy. It was not poppy, you know.
They had one foot in heavy metal, but also drew from funk, hip-hop, and even ska and industrial influences to create something entirely new. Fieldy's bass slapped and popped like a funk bassist. David's drumming mixed tribal rhythms with hip-hop beats. And Monkey and Head's guitars produced ominous atonal squeals and grinding seven-string riffs. To cap it off, Jonathan would unleash scat-like vocal gibberish and even play the bagpipes on certain songs.
I remember when the album came out, the only thing they can compare John's voice to is Eddie Vedder.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what?
Fucking weird.
That's identity, you know? Yeah. People need to attach.
Absolutely.
Something. But that feeling was so intense coming off their music and their performances was like, it was so heavy in an internal way that you couldn't deny it. It was there.
It was there.
Yeah, special and forever, like it'll never go away.
It was chaotic, confrontational, and absolutely original. With songs like Blind, which opens with Jonathan's iconic guttural shout of, "Are you ready?" Korn's debut was basically asking us if we were ready for a new sound that would later be called new metal, though nobody had a name for it yet.
Honestly, I can't tell you how many people have told me that we've created this new genre of metal, new rock, new metal. New metal. I don't really know how to take it. I do agree that we changed the music scene and put the course of heavy music on a different route.
At first, heavy metal purists didn't quite know what to make of Korn's hip-hop tinged grooves, and alternative rock crowds were baffled by their downtuned heaviness. In their first couple of years, Korn would get thrown onto all kinds of tour lineups, opening for punk bands, hardcore bands, even opening for No Doubt, simply because no one knew where they fit. However, what Korn lacked in mainstream support, they made up for with authenticity.
You know, emotionally, I think it's a little bit of a toll on Jonathan because a lot of the lyrics or some of the songs are just really personal about stuff he went through, you know?
Jonathan's lyrics spilled out his deepest traumas.
That is how I deal with the things that go on in life. And we all have shit going on in our life. It never stops. You know, earlier records are a lot me dealing with my childhood and stuff. But, you know, as each record goes on, you know, shit happens in life. And that's how I deal with it. So it's always been that. That's some people, you know, go to therapy or church or whatever they want to do. And it's all good. But for me, I got to just get it out with my art.
The lyrics were all dark and wild and revealing, you know.
The final track, Daddy, which I mentioned earlier, was the most infamous of all. In that song, Jonathan confronted the abuse he endured as a child, and during the recording, he broke down sobbing uncontrollably. Ross Robinson kept the tape rolling, capturing over a minute of Jonathan's anguished weeping at the end of the track. It's an uncomfortable, real moment that few artists would ever dare to put on a record. But Korn dared, and that brutal vulnerability struck a nerve with a generation of young listeners. Many kids who felt alienated, abused, or angry when they heard Korn's early songs knew exactly what that pain was about. Korn were outcasts and their fans were outcasts. So together they formed their own little tribe outside the mainstream.
And we didn't know if it was going to sell. Like, we thought that we could do okay because we had a sound, But I mean, even the record company told us, like, you'll be lucky if you sell 90,000 records or something. That'll be really good. So, like, for us to go multi-platinum, I'm just like, so, you know, just at the time, stepping back and look at the industry now, we got to step in before the records stopped selling, you know, so it was...
Talking about the records now would be...
Dude!
In 1996, Korn released Life is Peachy, debuting at number 3 on the Billboard charts. They had little radio play and almost no TV coverage. But what they had was a fiercely loyal fan base built from the ground up.
I've just been basically asking everybody this, like, what Lollapalooza means to them. Does it mean anything to you other than, like, a great festival where people hear varied music? Or
that's about it.
People, I think it means, like, drink all day.
By 1997, Korn was co-headlining Lollapalooza with Tool, introducing massive crowds to their heavy, genre-bending sound. But what came next would take everything to a new level. Follow the Leader hit in 98, and that's when Korn fully exploded. The album debuted at number 1 and immediately went multi-platinum, powered by hits like Got the Life and Freak on a Leash. Korn, once ignored by radio, was now all over MTV.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
The Freak on a Leash music video, known for its animated bullet and unique style, became a TRL favorite and also won a Grammy Award. Korn was now competing for airtime with Britney Spears and NSYNC, something no one could have imagined just a few years earlier.
And the electricity is in the air on a chilly November night. I'm Carson Daly. Welcome to Korn TV. The final day of Spectrum Music Week, and what a week it's been with Will Smith, Mariah Carey, Rage Against the Machine, Dr. Dre, and Snoop. Now, since it's Friday, we're going to dive right hard into this action. Korn is here to talk about...
Absurdly enough, the demand for Freak on a Leash got so insane that MTV had to retire it from the TRL countdown.
From the big day out, 99, Korn.
That same year, they started headlining arena tours and launched their own traveling festival, the Family Values Tour, bringing Rammstein, Limp Bizkit, and Ice Cube on the road. They even popped up in mainstream pop culture. Korn guest starred as animated versions of themselves in a 1999 Halloween episode of South Park, a Scooby-Doo style parody that cemented how far into the American mainstream this once outsider band had infiltrated.
Korn powers. Korn powers vitalize.
Monkey,
David,
Fieldy,
and Jonathan.
Form of Korn.
Bands influenced by Korn's sound and success were everywhere. Limp Bizkit, Slipknot, Deftones, Papa Roach, and countless others rode the wave of the new metal genre that Korn pioneered. Jonathan Davis, the bullied kid from Bakersfield, had done the impossible. He had become the voice of a generation. But here's the thing, success didn't make his pain go away. If anything, it made it louder. And the next phase of his journey would be even darker.
I was on a path to their death real quick. I was a raging drug addict, alcoholic, womanizer.
Behind the crowds in the spotlight, Jonathan Davis was in freefall. He was deep into meth, cocaine, and drinking heavily, often going through bottles of Jack Daniels like water. The recording process for Follow the Leader wasn't as much creative as it was chaotic. Fueled by speed and alcohol, Jonathan pushed himself to the edge. The studio basically turned into a drug den. Coke dust on the consoles, whiskey everywhere, and zero memory of how songs even got recorded. It was chaos, and Jonathan was barely holding on.
I actually turned a little bit schizophrenic for a while. Anxiety can do that to you, where you feel like, I was feeling like my food was going to be people trying to poison me. It was really a really tough time.
But during the 1998 Family Values Tour, he made a decision that probably saved his life.
So I stopped meth when we started touring because I couldn't function. There's no way I could be up for 2 days and tour and keep it together, and I had to stop. So the day we took off on tour, our first tour with House of Pain and Biohazard, we got in our trailer and we built bunks, and I just rented that bunk and I slept for 5 fucking days, got up and played a show, and that's when I kicked it.
At 28 years old, on top of the world but rotting inside, he finally chose to stop. Jonathan never used meth again, but alcohol became a growing problem.
It was impossible. I couldn't do meth and fucking tour. It wouldn't work. So I started drinking, and then I became a raging alcoholic. And cocaine occasionally when I could find it. But yeah, just they go hand in hand.
Later that year, after the death of his grandfather, Jonathan spiraled. Anxiety, panic attacks, depression, it all hit at once. While Follow the Leader was still topping the charts, Jonathan was put on suicide watch, monitored 24/7.
Depression came back, anxiety came back, and that's when I decided to get on meds, which helped me immensely. But I'd always have to deal with it.
That's the duality. Korn was on top of the world, but Jonathan was coming undone.
It happens when you're depressed or you're going through mental health issues is you like to try to self-medicate. Everyone I know that's really hurting inside usually becomes an alcoholic or a drug addict, and that's because they're trying to hide things that are going on that you can do. The best thing you can do is try to go get some help and talk to someone. You get on a medication that'll help. There's medications that will help. There's medications that make it worse. It's a crapshoot. It's hard, and it really is.
Jonathan turned to therapy, and the band kept moving.
I went through this therapy called EMDR therapy where I watched this like Knight Rider light back and forth. It's because I had post-traumatic stress disorder from working at the coroner's office, and I had horrible nightmares and shit. And the doctors explained to me that sometimes your brain, when you experience traumas, depression, that your brain can't properly store that away. So it keeps coming back to fucking haunt you in your dreams or in thoughts. And so I did that therapy, and it really helped a lot. So if people ask, you know, the doctors if they get help, that therapy really helped me. It helped me a lot.
Issues dropped in 1999, another widely acclaimed masterpiece.
It's called Issues because all of us have issues, I guess, and this album is just the story of the issues I had going on through the tours and everything. And I thought it was a great, great title for it. It just sums it up, basically, because everybody has them, so you can relate.
This is one of those albums that you can listen to from start to finish with no bad songs. And I think it even rivals their debut album, as well as Follow the Leader, for being the best in their discography.
But this is my favorite. This is for sure my favorite one. For sure my favorite one.
Around this time, Jonathan married his high school sweetheart, Renee Perez. They'd already had a kid, Nathan, born in 95. But the relationship didn't last. By 2000, the marriage had ended. Jonathan rarely speaks about it, but the picture is clear. Korn was exploding, the pressure was unsustainable, and his personal life was crumbling under the weight. Fame didn't bring him peace. Perhaps it made things worse, and Jonathan wasn't the only one struggling.
After the album Issues, Korn Issues, that's when my ex-wife left. And right then, I became a single father. I got full custody. And right then, my heart was no longer in Korn as much because it was at home with my kid. And I was trying to juggle her. And I was trying to figure out all these ways to raise her while still being in the band, you know, hiring nannies, and then the nannies would freak out. I'd have to hire another nanny, and just, it wasn't working, man. And instead of making the choice, I dove deeper into partying, you know, just to forget about it.
Untouchables followed in 2002, massive budget, massive sound, mixed reviews. The songs aren't as catchy as some of their other stuff, which turns some people off. But everyone in the band is firing on all cylinders, performing at their peak.
That record was when I became a real singer. All the effort, all this stuff that went in that record for 2 years, we worked hard on that. It was just incredible production, just the best of best of everything. That is my favorite Korn record, hands down.
We spent 2 years making that record.
Oh my
God. We spent $4 million making that record.
In 2003 came Take a Look in the Mirror, heavier and angrier than their previous works, arguably their heaviest album. Surely a nice banger when you're mad at something. In October 2004, Jonathan married Devin Augustina Chouette, a former adult film actress who had moved into fashion design. They had two sons together, Zeppelin and Pirate.
Just want to say Happy New Year to everybody. We have some things we want to talk about with Summer One. We hope y'all have an amazing new year. And what else?
We were actually going to tell all of you, everybody that paid full price, we did too. And thank you so very much. So what we decided to do was to take...
But as the years passed, the marriage began to fall apart. Devin faced serious mental health challenges and struggled with addiction. We don't know much about it, and frankly, we don't need to. However, it is public knowledge that things got so bad that in 2016, Jonathan filed for divorce.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
And sought a restraining order to protect their kids. It's a sad chapter that, as we'll see later, will end tragically.
What? Are we done?
Yeah, because these people need to get out there.
Get out and go
have fun.
Fun. It's New Year's.
Make sure. Uber. Drive
safe.
Yeah,
don't drive drunk. Be safe. Don't be dipshits. I hate dipshits.
Hey, get out of your car. Park it. Walk.
Walk.
See You on the Other Side in 2005 marked a shift. It was their first album without Head, who had quit the band to find some sense of normalcy in his life.
It was, I would just say that the methamphetamine habit and me being away from my daughter was just too much, man. I couldn't live like that anymore. I couldn't be away from my kid. I was a single father trying to hire nannies, and it was just a bunch of things, you know, at once. So,
despite a divided fan base, the album went platinum.
We kept moving. We just constantly kept working.
Meanwhile, Jonathan was grinding through panic attacks and insomnia until in 2006, on a European tour, he suddenly collapsed. His body was bizarrely covered in bruises. Doctors told him his blood platelets had crashed. The diagnosis was ITP, a rare disorder where your immune system eats your own platelets.
Immune thrombocytopenia, or ITP, is an autoimmune disease where your own body actually attacks your platelets, and therefore your blood can't clot and it can lead to a lot of bleeding issues.
All right, people, we got one more song for you tonight.
One wrong move on stage and he could have bled into his brain and died. Korn had to cancel the rest of the tour, and Jonathan spent weeks recovering in a London hospital. He came back shaken but alive, and more committed than ever. Coincidentally, around the same time, David Silveria, Korn's original drummer, stepped away from the band.
Hopefully he'll be back and we'll be rocking again.
Officially, it was called a break. Unofficially, things were unraveling. Years of aggressive drumming had wrecked his lower back, leaving him in chronic pain.
I just started feeling really tired when I was playing. I just couldn't play. Just the strength went away. Medical term, I hit too fucking hard. So it's like, it was just a freak thing. So I had to tell everyone, you know what, I can't play anymore. It was like a big, oh no, what are we going to do?
It was actually a few years that went by before I actually had my back repaired. But I was in so much pain, I couldn't even do anything. And I went to a doctor and I was misdiagnosed by an x-ray of the bones. And that went on for years before I went to a specialist because it got so bad, I couldn't even walk more than 10 feet without sitting down. And I went to another specialist and he held up my first x-ray and the new x-ray. And he said he could see from across the room in the first x-ray, my back was broken in 4 spots. So my inability to actually stand up, let alone walk or play or anything, it took a few months before I could actually even do any of those things. And once I could, I was never out of pain. It was killing me all the time. It was unbearable. It was ridiculous.
Add to that the emotional burnout, the touring grind, and growing tension with the rest of the band, and it was only a matter of time.
When we started out, we were all equal members, and everyone, everything was supposed to be voted on, and everyone had equal say in everything. And that slowly turned into a different way of things working that I totally 100% disagreed with.
He bowed out and Korn moved on without him. Later, David would claim he was never truly asked back. And whenever asked, he threw punches in interviews, saying Korn had lost its soul. The band, for their part, made it clear the door was closed. And according to most fans, Korn would never be the same again. The untitled album that came out in 2007, the first one without David, was widely slammed. Even Jonathan later called it soulless. Then came Korn 3, Remember Who You Are, in 2010, a back-to-basics attempt with producer Ross Robinson. Some fans loved the rawness, while others didn't even care about Korn anymore. The new metal era was long gone, and most bands from that era had already been forgotten, and Korn was fighting to stay relevant. So they pulled a bizarre move. In 2011, they dropped The Path of Totality, a full-on dubstep metal hybrid featuring producers like Skrillex and Noisia. Headed came back into the band, which felt miraculous. And his return seemed to give the band renewed clarity and a stronger sense of direction.
And everything fell into place, you know, and so the door opened and I'm back in Korn, and I felt like the Lord was saying, you know, I didn't mean no before, I meant not yet. Because he had stuff to work in me. And there's a time to leave and a time to come back, a time to, you know, follow him to crazy places and a time to follow him back to other crazy places. So that's why I'm back with Korn right now. And a lot of people are kind of, a lot of Christians are like confused about that and everything, but God's heart beats for everybody.
It was one of the most exciting times to be a Korn fan. However, the album itself ranges from mediocre to good. Love and Meth and Never Never stand among Korn's finest work, layered, powerful, and memorable. But by contrast, tracks like It's All Wrong felt undercooked. It's an album that unfortunately never reached its full potential. For some, it was a desperate attempt to ride the dubstep hype of the time. For others, it was genius. Either way, the album debuted at number 10 and won awards. Proof that Korn wasn't done yet. And neither were Jonathan's demons. In 2013, he checked into rehab for Xanax addiction. What started as medication for anxiety had turned into dependency. Eventually, he kicked it, but still smoked weed daily until 2015, just to keep his nerves in check. Truth is, at this point, Jonathan wasn't even chasing any high. He was just trying to feel normal. By 2016, Korn had dropped The Serenity of Suffering, an album that was widely received as a much welcome return to form.
And Jonathan, though, he had to kind of fall in love with heavy music again because, he went his own way with electronic stuff.
Sure.
And so with me and Monkey back, it was just like, you know, we really need to be guitar focused, and we you can't put us back together and just have a little bit of guitars. Like, we need to be just firing on all cylinders, like Monkey likes to say.
Critics loved it. Metal Hammer called it their most visceral in years, and Loudwire named it one of the best metal albums of the year. Songs like Rotting in Vain and A Different World featuring Corey Taylor sounded like classic Korn, but with a precision that only comes after decades in the game. It debuted at number 4 on Billboard. 20 years in, most bands are just selling reunion tickets, while fucking Korn was still dropping bodies. Watching Jonathan Davis on stage, you'd think everything was perfect. Same kilt, same roar, same possessed energy. But backstage, his life was still a shit show. He was in the middle of a brutal divorce with Devin, fighting for custody and trying to raise kids while dealing with someone who was losing the fight to addiction.
He's so nice. The guy's so sweet, and he lets people kind of walk over him. Even to really? This day, yeah, he puts up a lot. If he loves someone, they can, like, you know, they can do damage on him, and he'll just be, you know, he'll stick it out, and wow. He'll believe the best and everything. And
in 2018, Jonathan Davis faced two devastating losses. In February, his mother, Holly, passed away. She had been a rare source of stability in a life marked by chaos, and her absence left a deep, bottomless void. Then, in August, came an even messier tragedy. His estranged wife, Devin, died from an overdose caused by heroin and prescription medication. Devin's struggles with addiction and mental illness had been ongoing for years. Although Jonathan had supported her through multiple attempts at recovery, progress was always temporary. Over time, the addiction altered her personality, making her unpredictable and unsafe for herself and, tragically, for their children. Which is why, in 2016, Jonathan was granted a restraining order against her. Still, when the news came that Devin was gone, all that drama, all the fights, the court orders, the anger, all of that fell away. I loved her with all of my being, he wrote in a vulnerable Instagram post days later. He asked fans not to judge her, saying she was an amazing mother and wife when she was sober, but that she'd been very, very sick in the end. Addiction isn't about being good or bad. It's an illness, one that keeps taking until there's nothing left to take. For Jonathan, that meant grieving twice. First for the woman he'd lost to drugs years earlier, and then for the woman whose heart finally stopped. That same year, he released his long-awaited solo album, Black Labyrinth. Unlike Korn's heavier catalog, this album embraced slower tempos, experimental structures, and global musical influences. It reflected a period of intense introspection shaped by the personal darkness he had been living through. It wasn't built to dominate the charts. It was too intimate for that.
And I just finished doing some vocals and stuff on some stuff a couple weeks ago. So it's been a long process, but it turned out great. I'm so happy with it.
Are you surprised by everybody's reaction? Were you worried about how we would take it?
Yeah, of course.
And then,
I don't know if people will dig it, but it was the same with Korn. I had no clue. I mean, when the first Korn record came out, I had no idea so many people felt the way I felt. It was overwhelming. And this is the same thing when I put the song on. There's like, there's been a lot of people really just that. It brings out something that song brings out some emotion. I mean, I'm very happy that it's touching them in a good way.
Jonathan had always used music to bleed out whatever's poisoning him, but Black Labyrinth bled differently. less like a gaping wound, more like a slow IV drip of loss, confusion, and fragile hope. By 2019, the grief had hardened into something else. Out of it came The Nothing, which turned out to be one of Korn's most personal and best records ever. The Serenity of Suffering had been strong, but some tracks blurred together. The Nothing fixed that. Each track had its own identity, its own weight, and some of the catchiest riffs they'd ever written.
But I've had a whole year to reflect. I mean, that pain don't go away, but you know, I'm moving on with my life, and I got a lot of great things going on. So try not to dwell in the past. It's tragic and it sucks, but I'm not going to let it take me out. It's not going to win.
By 2021, Jonathan Davis had already crawled through fire. Childhood trauma, addiction, burying his mother, watching his estranged wife die from an overdose, and then COVID sucker punched him. He caught it mid-tour and left him pale, coughing, gasping for air. Most people would have taken a month off from work, but for a frontman who spends 2 hours a night screaming his lungs out, this shit was potentially career-stopping. Instead, Jonathan kept performing on stage, sitting on a throne with an oxygen tank at his side, hitting it between songs just to survive the set. Someone else would have canceled the tour, but Jonathan doubled down. Every night became a fight against his own body, just a broken man refusing to stop.
All those crazy notes, all that stuff that's on all your old records, you're still pulling off. So what are you doing with your voice?
I mean, I warm up, I warm down. I've been sober since 1998. I'm just coming up a couple days, it'll be 21 years. So that has a lot to do with it, and just taking care of my voice. And this is why I do interviews after, and I don't do that many interviews.
In early 2022, Korn released Requiem. The album was shorter, more concise, but rich in texture. For Jonathan, it was a document of survival, proof that even after illness, grief, and decades of chaos, there was still fuel left in the tank. Critics noted its balance of melody and aggression, and fans saw it as a hopeful turn without losing the band's core darkness. It wasn't about erasing the pain, it was about living with it.
So I think I was just in a great headspace, and it kind of just translated throughout the whole music, out of everything, and we made just a different record.
Yeah,
I mean, it's hard. It's a 14th record.
God. Crazy how it happens like that.
Right. It's just so crazy. I'm like, wow, how we keep doing this? But I'm not going to mess with the process or how it happens. It's definitely something special and from someplace else.
But that's the thing about Jonathan. There's no fairy tale here, no cathartic happy ending. He's still not fixed. He still wakes up with anxiety gnawing at his chest. And he still battles depression and endless nights of insomnia. But he hasn't gone back to the hard drugs that almost killed him. And he's still showing up for his kids.
I don't know. They're my everything. And I got three of them. They're just beautiful little dudes. And my oldest is 22 years old. And Pirate's going to be 13 in a couple weeks. And Zeppy's going to be 11. Yeah. So I don't know. I love hanging out with them. I include them in everything I do. I take them on the road with me every summer. And I have them stay with me in my studio, and we just shoot hoops in the studio and listen to music.
He's also still showing up for his fans, still creating, still screaming into microphones, and still turning his pain into something that makes other people feel less alone.
I think music's one of the most powerful things in the entire world. It has the power to heal people. It has the power to bring people together, no matter what you're into. It's just a beautiful thing, and that's why I threw myself wholeheartedly into making music, because that is my drugs now. That is my antidepressant. That is everything to me.
Jonathan Davis has made a career and a life out of dragging his demons into the light and daring them to kill him. And so far, they haven't.